Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Are Australian citizens more likely to die in a foreign war or in a war at all in the next 5 years, or are they more likely to die from getting, you know, burned alive or swept away in a flood?
We need to do a real risk assessment on climate change, on, you know, a national security, economic security and kind of social fronts, and we need to do it regionally because climate change doesn't stop at the water's edge.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, James Mortensen and Anastasia Kapetas join Will Stoltz to explore the increasing threat of natural disasters in Australia and the suitability of the Australian Defence Force to respond to them. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the lands from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Anastasia, James, thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much.
So I wanted to speak with you, both of you, because I think you've both in your own respective ways thought very deeply about the intersection of environmental issues with Australia's national security. Yeah, this is obviously a pretty vivid topic for many Australians currently who are being impacted by, you know, historic flooding events in Queensland and New South Wales. But to those that might be kind of generally sceptical as to why we should look at environmental issues and natural disasters through a national security lens, I'm wondering if we can just start by having you both kind of explain why we should actually consider these issues through a national security perspective.
In many cases, It's difficult to consider it just through a national security lens because essentially climate change is about everything. It's it's deep, structural, cascading, multi-level kind of phenomenon. But in terms of classic national security, I think it's interesting to think about if you compare, say, climate change to the damage from climate change to a country, say, to a major invasion of a country. It's a longer tail, but nonetheless, the damage is same, if not worse. But the other issue for climate change is that, you know, it's an equal opportunity kind of destroyer of systems. So it's not just one country being invaded. It's all countries. So just in the most simple terms, in terms of damage, to nations, cost to nations, this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. The thing with climate change as well is that there's really acute effects like natural disasters and cascading natural disasters. So instead of having one natural disaster at a time in a year, countries might experience sort of up to 10 or 15. That quickly overwhelms resources and abilities to respond and to adapt. But there's also cumulative effects as well. So, you know, changes to sea level temperatures, which more slowly over time start to denude fish stocks on which populations might depend on protein. And that's Indonesia's scenario. Or changes to the Gulf Stream, for example, which might have a tipping effect on weather, but again, affects all these other kinds of ecosystems in a slower way. So there's those things as well. So in a sense, it's understandable why people can't get their heads around the dimensions of the challenge that we face here. Again, from a really just sort of straight up kind of security angle, it's often said that climate change will metastasize current conflicts, but of course it will also drive new conflicts. There's a school of thought out there that says that at the end of the day, all conflict is about water and access to water. So a lot of people are looking at things like the Himalayan watersheds, the Mekong Delta, the river systems in Africa and the river systems in Europe as possible loci for future conflicts as well. In more immediate terms, really immediate terms, and especially in terms of the idea of having to respond to natural disaster crises here and in our near region. Of course, when militaries are used to deploy in that way, it means they can't do other things. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden we have, you know, a force that's really focused on high-end war fighting. That's what they're trained to do and trained to support, doing a very different kind of mission. And we haven't really seen the government in Australia, at least, give extra resources to the ADF for those purposes. I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, from my perspective, I'm echoing everything Anastasia said, which I think, you know, especially taking broadly from a more, you know, international security angle, let's say. I mean, I'd only add, I suppose, an attempt at a sobering note, which would be, you know, if security essentially, we'll say it's the maintenance of the viability of the state, right? You know, the Australian government's responsibility to national security is to ensure that the Australian community still exists in the way that it wishes to exist and come moving forward. Just from a purely domestic Australian perspective, you know, everything else be damned. Like, we've set our nation up to operate under certain circumstances. We know, we should know all by now that this, the continent itself is carefully balanced, was carefully balanced, is probably no longer carefully balanced. And we've set communities and systems, resource acquisition, you know, agriculture on a variety of different points on the continent. And they are simply no longer viable, or may not be viable moving forward if all things remain equal within a short amount of time, not a long amount of time. So especially, obviously, the Murray-Darling has been a perennial issue for Australia since colonisation. But, you know, it's obviously from the last 5 to 10 years, anyone who's paid attention can see that it's becoming more and more tenuous and really reaching a point where we can't necessarily assume that we can plant more almond trees and it's all going to work out. And that's just one example, unfortunately. So, you know, going back to the sort of the main point, like in what way is, you know, climate intersecting with national security, at least from an Australian lived experience point of view in the next 5 to 10 years? I mean, well, it's right now, obviously, as you said, with the floods. But, you know, from my point of view, especially water systems, how they interact and not so much where the water is and where it's going and how much we have, but simply our capacity to rely on it in the ways that we traditionally have. The amount of upheaval that I think that is already starting to cause is such that we need to fundamentally address what our community expectations are and therefore the viability of that community moving forward.
And you think that the best way to start to address those kind of existential challenges is to frame these environmental issues? Because, you know, you mentioned water and the fact that that's been a persistent issue for Australia kind of well before we even really had a conception of climate change. Do you think still that framing these issues in a national security through a national security lens is the best way to mobilise action?
Look, I mean, here I am speaking with the National Security College as an employee of the National Security College. I would say that the honest answer, God forbid, I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, does it matter
if that's what we
need to do?
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, it's because it's part of this wider conversation of what is national security,
the
broadening and deepening of national security since the Cold War. And like, it finally, okay, using the Murray-Darling as an example, right?
Yeah.
When Federation was first getting put together, you had South Australia and New South Wales as separate colonies going to war over what was going to be included in the Constitution. And there are, in fact, specific clauses of the Constitution to try and you know, make them feel happy about it and join up because South Australia's economic security was contingent on river traders, paddle steamers, and New South Wales's economic security was contingent on extensive irrigation from agriculture. And even in 1898, South Australia was worried about the amount of water that New South Wales was taking, stopping the riverboats from getting through, right? So in those days, did they call it national security? No. Yeah. Okay, would we call, an impasse that prevents a community from getting economic security, national security? Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, like ultimately, you know, we need to pull whatever policy levers are going to get the job done.
Yeah.
Which I suppose does make it national security. If it's something that needs to happen, then sure, I'll call it that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, look, if the Minister for Water wants to roll in, or whoever, the Agriculture Department, anybody, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be defence. It doesn't have to be like, let's just bloody fix it.
Yeah. No, I don't want to dwell too much on it, but it's just, these framings of issues are important for the policy community about how they kind of mobilise resources and action. I want to go now, I guess, to specifically Australia's national capacity to respond to the myriad of different disasters and issues, that Anastasia, you kind of touched on. Like, as we mentioned, extreme flooding in New South Wales and Queensland are kind of just the most recent instances of a kind of seemingly rolling series of domestic crises impacting Australians, including COVID-19 pandemic and the bushfires. And in all these kind of instances, the ADF have been a central part of the response. And so there's several questions I want to ask about that particular issue. But firstly, kind of in your view, just as a general starting principle, is the military the best placed agency from a capability point of view to actually undertake this kind of first responder role?
In many ways, no. And the ADF will acknowledge that again, because they're not set up. They can do HADR, but they can't do it alone, and they really depend on a whole bunch of other government services and agencies to make any impact on the ground. Basically, yes, they can help. They're not particularly postured to help right now in the ways that we will need, that kind of intervention. And so it will need a real rethink of the ADF's mission, but also resourcing.
Mm. Yeah, and I suppose that's what's perhaps not articulated as clearly in the public debate is the opportunity cost of by having the ADF so frequently deployed domestically, what you're undercutting them being able to do in the more traditional military sense in terms of their preparedness to deploy abroad, that sort of thing. But James, I wanted to ask you, I guess, taking a kind of more philosophical approach to thinking about the role of the military in a liberal democratic society, do you think that there are risks or downsides by the fact that we are deploying our military domestically so frequently?
Risk, and with all respect, I appreciate it. It's a good question, genuine question. Like, risk as a category by which we can make these decisions, I think it's almost like we bandy it around sort of too much. Risks against what?
Yeah.
Let's say, right? Yeah. Is it risks against lowered warfighting capacity? Well, yeah, yes, because it will. I mean, but we know that. And I, from what I can understand, or from what I've seen and from what I've heard, in a professional context, that seems to be the risk that we are most interested in weighing it up against, right? Like the risks of people getting washed away in floods, or the risk of property damage, whatever, versus the risks of our decreased in warfighting capacity.
Mm.
Now, I'm not necessarily saying that the ADF is the best responder or anything like that, but to me, maybe a more suitable, if we were going to talk about it in terms of risk, it would be more suitable to say, well, are Australian citizens more likely to die in a foreign war or in a war at all in the next 5 years, or are they more likely to die from getting, burned alive or swept away in a flood? And if the answer is the latter, then I'm not saying, again, to be clear, I'm not necessarily making an argument that the ADF should be the ones to do it, but it would certainly seem reasonable to expect that it could well be part of their remit, or at least that there needs to be some adjustment to that remit if they are here to protect Australia, right? But even that said, the idea that we're weighing up against risks, I would like to think – and this is definitely the sort of luxury of being an armchair critic rather than having to make the decisions. I appreciate that, but in a nation placed as well as Australia is economically, technologically, et cetera, I wonder the degree to which we have to weigh up risks, and the degree instead we should be looking for let's call it a minimum viable product.
Yeah.
Right? Now, for minimum viable product is that people not getting burnt alive, because we need to be able to respond to what we know is happening. I believe we have the capacity. It might be more a question of what are we willing to trade rather than what we are willing to risk.
Well, and this is kind of what I was getting at, I suppose, is just by that idea of having in a liberal democratic country where we, as a starting principle, believe that the military should operate within a kind of fairly clearly defined bounds and be oversighted by civilians and all that sort of stuff, that by having the frequent deployment of the military on Australian streets, whether it be, I mean, we're focusing here in this conversation in disaster response, but obviously, you know, we've seen, you know, in the wake of COVID, soldiers in nursing homes, these sorts of things. Like, are there things that we need to be conscious of about, I suppose, impacts on social cohesion and public trust by seeing the military deployed so frequently in a domestic way? Because, you know, if I put myself in the shoes of a first or second generation migrant to Australia that's come from a country where the military has a very negative impact in society, and I'm potentially, you know, sitting in a nursing home or something like that, and I'm seeing a lot of uniforms around me, that could make me quite potentially quite nervous. Do we need to be factoring those wider ramifications into our thinking around deploying the military domestically?
I mean, I'd say absolutely. And, you know, obviously, well, Will knows full well, looking into messaging mental health and how these things might affect national security moving forward, something that I don't think we do enough of. Something else, though, it reminds me of talking to the luxury, especially teaching here, and talking to a lot of guys that were actually on the ground in flood response, fire response in the last 2 years. Something that I've found overwhelmingly from all of them was that they actually wanted to do it, which is interesting. Also, at the same time, though, to pay respect to it, they were all, without fail, they were all worried about how they were to be expected to do it, because it hasn't been necessarily made clear to them where this extra training, where this extra time, where this extra capacity is going to come from. But the other thing more relevant to your question, I think, is one bloke who talked to me in particular told a story of cleaning up after the last floods, you know, 2020, 2021. And cleaning up next to SES personnel and RFS personnel who'd helped out, and everyone in the muck, knee-deep in the muck, you know, trying to shovel mud and get everybody's belongings out of there, and people walking past, in this particular location at least, pulling up the soldiers constantly to take selfies and thank them so much for their hard work, while the SES people were just knee-deep in muck, keeping on going, you know. What that did to their morale, what that did to their conception, and the concerns that they had, obviously, about exactly where you're speaking, like people in fatigues out in the public, which is not their traditional role, what effect that might have, whether it's positive or negative on any particular way. I do think, though, yeah, you're getting to a bigger, maybe unfortunately more politically charged question of the optics of having fatigues on the ground, whether it's a nursing home or a fire or a flood. It might not please everybody, but I can see how it's certainly say, inverted commas, gets the job done from an optics point of view. And I would be interested in trying to appreciate how, if we were to use the ADF as moving forward or continue to cement this role, if that's something that we need to manage, and if we did want to manage it, how?
I think just also, I mean, when you keep doing that, what you're sending a message that to get the job done in any way, shape or form, you need the military, that the military is the only institution in Australia that really works. And that's not only not true, but can become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy if resources keep going to the ADF and none of the other agencies, which is so critical here, that the ADF just can't replicate and could never replicate health and emergency services, you know, for example.
We'll be right back. Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, you know, we've spoken there about the issues we need to factor in when we're deploying the military domestically. But thinking about it afresh, I suppose, what should an alternate agency or force look like, particularly in our kind of federal system? You know, is there – there have been suggestions by some saying that we need a dedicated civil defense force, like a kind of separate – potentially a separate service or a dedicated federal agency for these types of things. You know, do you think that's the way to go, or – given we exist in a federalization, a federation, do we need a more decentralized approach to these things? I'm not sure. Anastasia, you might have a view.
Look, there's so many plans out there that real experts in disaster response have suggested, and I'd encourage people to go and have a look at those. But I'm just going to talk about a couple of general principles. And one is that in terms of centralization or decentralization, what you need is a decentralized approach that's highly coordinated, so that both those things have to happen at the same time. And that kind of makes it a bit more anti-fragile. So there's that. In terms of another principle, if we want to keep global warming to 1.52, we cannot afford fires like we had 2 years ago. And everywhere else in the world can't afford that either. So we need to come up with a plan to minimise that as much as possible. And we haven't really begun to do that. And not only that, we have to be able and willing to help others in the region do the same. Mm. So we need to help Indonesia put out wildfires extremely early. I mean, God forbid, we also need to think about places like Russia and their Siberian, you know, tiger forests. How are we going to help Russia cope with that scenario? We also need to think about, you know, the other big carbon things like the Amazon, you know, as well. So I just wanted to point out that it's not just, you know, fires here that we need to be thinking about, but fires globally. Now, at COP26, there was some thinking about that in the margins. That's conversations that's happening kind of at a sub-government level. But as a real principle, that's one of the things we need to really think about. And James can probably talk more about water as a basic thing that we need to organise around.
I mean, well, I suppose, look, I'll use water as the segue. I think, yes, there are. As Anastasia said, there's plenty of plans by people who know far more than me on possibilities. But from an armchair critic point of view, I'd echo and controversialize, I suppose, like the idea that we need to organize ourselves to create a force or to, you know, supplement the ADF to be a force or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's, to me, still worthwhile, still something worth doing. But it's worthwhile doing in the sense of putting a Band-Aid on is worthwhile. It's just that we better bloody disinfect what we're putting on. There's no point.
Yeah.
Right? So if we are talking about how we can move forward, yeah, sure, disaster team, disaster force 5, you know, ultra edition, let's do it, new uniforms, whatever. Yeah, that's great. Love it. Also, yeah, how about backburning?
Yeah.
How about getting our act together with Murray Darling? How about actually measuring how much water we're losing out of the Great Artesian Basin? How about all of this sort of stuff? How about actually minimizing, right? Because ultimately, you don't need to read expert disaster response, you know, manifestos to understand that the prevalence of these disasters is occurring because of our relationship to the environment. And so we could, you know, match the ADF dollar for dollar, create, you know, our new disaster force, a supreme team. But any conversation that sees to siphon that off from the greater issue, it's not a matter of sort of bashing the green drum. It's just matter of fact, talking about national security, or this is a national security issue. Well, ensuring that we are extremely responsible with taking water out of the Great Artesian Basin is a national security issue now. Because communities all across northern New South Wales, southwestern Queensland absolutely rely on it, and otherwise you've got 100,000 people, you know, 200 years worth of whatever commerce, if you want to put it like that, God forbid, that all of a sudden evaporates, and that hurts the bottom line. I hate talking in those terms, but it hurts the bottom line. So I'll actually draw something in the sand. Domestically, look, we got to just get our act together.
Mm.
Start. I mean, especially to use the example, backburning New South Wales, in the 2019 bushfires, it being revealed that, you know, our budget for actually organising backburns had dropped by such a ridiculous amount. I don't even remember what the amount was. Let's do that before we really sort out the disaster force. On the flip side, let's get a disaster force. I'm all for it. Let's stick it with the ADF, but let's make it a dedicated disaster force, and let's make it not simply for domestic, but we're also going to deploy it overseas, and we're going to be good global citizens, and that's going to be a very positive thing in every manner. Look after our backyard. It doesn't just help them. It helps us. It helps everybody.
So in a way, just to echo James's points, which I agree with completely, a lot of this needs to start with departments of Treasury and Finance.
Right.
So we need to start factoring the true cost of climate change into our economic modelling. We haven't done that. That's really step one. The second thing, from a broad all of government point of view, we need to do a real risk assessment on climate change, on national security, economic security, and kind of social fronts. And we need to do it regionally, because climate change doesn't stop at the water's edge. So I think those two things, just say, for an incoming government, if you're listening, what should we do? Do those two things first, and then you can try and figure out how to allocate the resources that we're talking about here.
Yeah, it strikes me that there is kind of a cultural shift that needs to happen within the Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth's predisposition is so often to take charge and be the leader in all of these kinds of aspects, particularly in a national security context. But as you were kind of highlighting, James, this issue is probably the most wicked problem that the Federation can confront, because of all the different jurisdictional issues about who's responsible for what. But it, as you were saying, that it sounds like the Commonwealth's greatest value add is probably in those kind of that larger strategy forming the assessments level, that to then inform what is hopefully a kind of, I suppose, more joined up federal response. But it's certainly a wicked, wicked problem. I can't think of it. I can't think of a more kind of existential challenge to the functioning of a federation, really.
But I mean, like, that's sort of, to me, part of, talking about wicked problems. I mean, like, obviously, in its physicality, it's a wicked problem, right? But then, like, the fact is, people like the Band-Aid much more than they like the Dettol, right? Like, no one likes the sting. We like knowing it's all better. So going for those sorts of measures is not particularly popular. It's not particularly sexy. On top of that,
or fast,
right? Yeah. As on top of that, the perennial political issue of is it something that I'm going to see results of in an election cycle? Probably not. Is it something that's going to cost me? Probably. Not particularly fun. And like all of this seems to me, it snowballs. It adds up. And to add the last sort of point, go back to your sort of one, I think your first question, right? National security, or to what degree is this national security? Like, the last thing is that, yes, it's existential. Yes, it's fundamental. Yes, the security community, the defence community has to engage with it. They are engaging with it. And in a lot of ways, they've been engaging with it probably quite robustly for longer than some other areas of government, certainly. And that's great, except because of its physicality, because of its wickedness, because of these various component problems, it's sort of almost – it's both the quintessential security issue and also a completely abnormal one, right? So it's fundamentally a security issue in the sense that it's existential, it's everything, it's total, it completely determines the future of our community and the viability of it moving forward. At the same time, the security apparatus and the security expectation, or I want to even call it the security culture that we live in, is very much – the exceptional circumstance, the circumstance where the rules don't apply anymore and we need to swoop in and solve the problem now, right, and then hand it back to regular policy. Except that probably so that's why I think one of the many reasons we look at a disaster force before we look at the more fundamental, brick and mortar stuff that would be traditionally in the purview of traditional policy. I'm not saying it shouldn't remain the purview of traditional policy, but it does make it hard to determine who and how we're going to act, I suppose.
I just, would say, I think, James, you said, this all looks, all this sort of action for climate change looks hard and expensive and people have to sacrifice stuff in the now and that's really boring. I think, like, juxtaposed against that is kind of the view of most recently expressed by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, which is that because climate change fundamentally changes geopolitical power, the way that power is distributed and people's natural geophysical advantages in one way or another, especially around energy, changes all of that. The countries that are going to succeed in the future, geopolitically or in any other way, or just in a survival sense, are going to be the ones that start to frame their national security as resilience. And that is a very different set of problems than framing national security around an invader or an external force. And that's one thing. So that, you know, on a national security front, those that are able to do that will have a geopolitical advantage. But the second thing is economically, of course, and that those countries that are able to make the energy transition, that are able to, you know, put resources to some sort of resilience and adaptation, they're the ones that are going to be the economic winners and in, you know, in classic geopolitical terms, have more power. So it's... On the one hand, it's like, oh, God, like, you know, we don't want to sacrifice stuff now, but we kind of already are. If you look at sort of COVID and what we've dealt with in the natural environment over the last few years, we've paid a lot already. The costs are already, you know, really, really mounting. So I guess, you know, it's probably better to think of all of this pursuing those sorts of policies as really, you know, not just nation building, but, you know, this helps us become safer and more powerful in a system that is changing so rapidly under our feet. I think Russia's the news, so I'm just going to talk about Russia. I interviewed Fiona Hill earlier this year, who was ex-Trump administration official on Russia, and we were talking about the fact that Russia's long-term trajectory, economic trajectory, is so dire in the next 10 years as the world moves away from fossil fuels. They haven't been able to replace that or diversify the economy. And there's a political problem because all of their political elites depend on oil and gas for their living and they can't imagine doing it any other way. So they also suffer from this real sort of resource curse politics that makes them really, really kind of rigid in terms of response. And at the same time, they're going to suffer pretty catastrophic climate change across their landmass. So and at the same time as that, they have a system where no real political transition is possible. Even after Putin, dies, which inevitably he will.
Really? Are we sure?
That's right. There's no clear political process. So Russia's dealing with a whole bunch of existential crises at once, not just out of this Ukraine war and the sanctions that they're also kind of accruing. So we don't, as a country, as a fossil fuel producer as well, we don't want to be in that case, and luckily we have a much more diversified economy than Russia does. But again, I think we just need to start thinking about our futures in very different ways. The kind of future that we saw for ourselves under most of the modern era is no longer a viable one, and we have to start thinking in another direction.
Yeah, we need to embrace this this idea that there is strategic advantage in resilience. I want to just tease out the resilience point though, because I think you were driving us in this direction, James. I mean, our relationship with our environment has to change in Australia. You know, we know the impacts of climate change. We know that a significant amount of them are already kind of baked in to the world that we're going to be living in. Is there kind of a sad reality that we have to confront that, you know, we are in a more hostile continent to what we've historically existed in, and therefore perhaps as citizens, our expectations and our relationship with what we can expect from our governments to respond actually have to change, that the resilience has to actually have to be kind of devolved to us as individual citizens, that there's not going to be a kind of cavalry coming over the hill to help us respond to every natural disaster, and therefore the way we live needs to change.
I'm really wary of that sort of thinking.
Okay.
On one level, right? On a very, very angry old man level, I'm like, look, when I'm president of the Australian Republic, air conditioning banned for everybody except, you know, nursing homes and hospitals, right? Yep. And you can live with it. If you don't like the heat, move to Tassie.
Yeah, right? yeah, yeah.
On one level, sure. But that's just my grumpy old man times. I mean, when I sit down and try and be reasonable, I think it's really unfair. I think it's fundamentally unfair to push onto the average Australian. And so use an example of things we could do, like backburning, for example,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, insurance, right, which is getting some media traction finally. But, people can no longer insure what little they have, right, because it's no longer necessarily financially viable, for example. And so then when the worst does happen, if the worst does happen, then who picks up those pieces, right? And are you going to turn to them and say, oh, well, I know that you inherited your parents' house when they carked it and it just happens to be traditionally on a floodplain that never used to get flooded, but now it does, so
move on.
Tough.
Yeah.
Right? These are the choices that we have to make. I know I appreciate you maybe more, we're more thinking about, well, turning off your aircon or paying more for petrol or that sort of thing. I think that's a very slippery slope though, and I note that it's a slippery slope that it would be irresponsible to go down until, as Anastasia said, we actually, the people who are in a position to model this stuff and can actually help shape community expectations and can actually help, you know, program how we can move forward. If, for example, a government did model all of that and say, look, we've crunched the numbers and the fact is, I know you're paying a lot for fuel, but you're just going to have to keep paying a lot for fuel because we can't, right? And maybe we can ease your pain in some other ways, right? Electric car subsidies or whatever else. Okay. Then sure, right? But I think it's fundamentally unfair to expect people to sort of tighten the bootstraps, tighten the belts, in a fashion that isn't orchestrated, because we know fundamentally that this problem is created specifically by the way we are currently orchestrated. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Like if this is a problem of how we've organized ourselves over the last 100 years, we can't simply expect from the ground up that individuals are going to sort themselves out and it'll all work out. I think it really needs to be led from the top.
Just echo that. Individuals can't deal with structural problems, and this is a structural problem.
That's a really quick way of saying that ramble that I just had. Thank you.
Yeah. No, and it's a good point to note on, because that's what we seek to achieve here, you know, at the National Security College, is to provide insight and advice and hopefully some kind of provocative thinking in terms of to try and spark how, you know, structural changes, whether it be on this topic but any other kind of national security issue, how they might happen in the Australian policymaking system. So, James, Anastasia, thanks so much for taking the time to have a discussion with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Will.
Thanks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.